Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm Ayan Bior in Washington. Here are some of the stories we're covering today. Tuesday, November 29th, 2016. President Kiir travels to South Africa to brief President Zuma on implementing the peace deal.
The President of the Republic will be briefing his counterpart and how the transitional government of national unity has smoothly started to implement the peace agreement.
And Sudanese activists demonstrate outside Sudan's embassy here in Washington. We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. President Salva Kiir and four of his ministers left South Sudan today for a two-day official trip to South Africa. The president's spokesman says while in South Africa, Mr. Kiir will not meet his rival, former First Vice President Riek Machar. Mr. Kiir is expected to meet with President Zuma. Tito Justin has more for VOA from Juba.
This is Mr. Kiir's first visit to South Africa since the fighting broke out in Juba in July between his forces and those loyal to Machar. President Kiir is expected to brief South African President Jacob Zuma about progress on implementing the 2015 peace deal. Presidential spokesman Atheni Wek Atheni told reporters at Juba International Airport that South Africa is a key player in the search for peace in South Sudan.
The President of the Republic will be briefing his counterpart and how the transitional government of national unity has smoothly started to implement the peace agreement, and particularly on the issue of security, which is now improving because most of the SPLM-SPLA-IO soldiers are actually moving to containment areas. And the two parties that signed the peace agreement and the former enemies, now partners in peace, are now working to ensure that the two armies are actually united by May 17.
South African President Jacob Zuma is the first African nation to host both President Kiir and Machar at the same time, but the two rivals are not expected to meet. Ethiopia and Sudan have both refused to grant Machar an entry visa to cross the border back into South Sudan. Again, Atheni Wek Atheni.
If Riek Machar is still in South Africa, it's a business for South Africa government to undertake. We don't doubt the ability of South Africa to deal with the issue. Already we have said categorically clear that Riek Machar is not one of the political leaders in the country, and therefore he shouldn't be one of the people meeting the president.
Atheni says the transitional government of national unity has no business with Riek Machar.
Riek Machar has since undo his ability as a political leader in the country by attacking State House on July 7, and already the SPLM-SPLM-IO has replaced him with General Taban Dengai. So SPLM-IO cannot have two leaders, and we cannot deal with two leaders.
Riek Machar was forced out of Juba and entered the Democratic Republic of Congo with help from the UN after fighting in July between government and rebel forces left more than 300 people dead and many others displaced. Some of Machar's forces are still in the Democratic Republic of Congo. Last week, after Machar, his wife, and some supporters failed to cross into South Sudan via Ethiopia or Sudan, he returned to South Africa where he was given an entry visa. The Kiir administration has banned Machar from practicing politics in the country after the July fighting in Juba. In August, President Kiir told a Kenyan journalist that Machar is free to return to Juba if he renounces violence. Among the top government officials who accompanied President Kiir are SPLM-IO Deputy Chairman Alfred Ladugore, Defense Minister Col Manyang, and the Minister in the Office of the President, Mayik Ayi. For VOA News, I am Tito Justin in Juba.
The South Sudan government says it plans to increase the collection of non-oil revenue in hopes of turning around its devastated economy. A three-day training workshop kicked off in Juba, which focuses on the oversight role of parliament in monitoring tax collection across the country. Waki Simon Wudu has this report for VOA from the capital, Juba.
South Sudan Deputy Finance Minister Mary Jarvis says the ongoing conflict has hurt the country's main source of revenue, oil. She says on top of South Sudan's internal strife, the price of oil dropped dramatically on the international market over the past year.
The decrease is huge, you know, because there are wells that were destroyed during the 2013 crisis, and you are well aware of that. And therefore, what it means is that the production of oil then has decreased. I don't have the exact figures, but the level of production is not as before. Now with the peace, we need to renovate or repair those wells.
Over the years, the South Sudan has heavily relied on oil revenue to fund 98% of its annual budget. Jarvis did not disclose how much revenue the government has lost in the oil sector as a result of the nearly three-year-long conflict. Ezekiel Lolgatkwoth, South Sudan's petroleum minister, said last month that because of the conflict, South Sudan now pumps about 165,000 barrels of oil per day as compared to nearly 350,000 barrels in 2011 when it gained its independence. The Japanese government is sponsoring the three-day workshop in which officials from the four states of Jubek, Yei, Budwe, and Awil are being trained on how to monitor non-oil revenue collection. Jarvis says the training is aimed at transparent and accountable collection of non-oil revenue.
I don't have exact figures on the top of my head. But with this kind of training and focus on this area, we hope at least to triple the collection of our non-oil revenue.
Jarvis says the training focuses on sharpening the skills of lawmakers to assess and monitor physical decentralization in the country, understand the non-oil revenue generating systems at the state level, and the different sources of revenue reserves for subnational governments. Naptali Hasengale, Speaker of the Yei River State Assembly, says the training will help local leaders set up taxation systems. He says state officials have not been able to collect taxes due in part to the ongoing conflict.
It's a little bit serious because, for example, when we talk about Yei River State, movement between Kaya Road has virtually ceased. There are no business people who could risk and travel through that road. Therefore, meaning that the local resources that can be generated locally are no longer there.
Eugen Owusu, the resident representative of the United Nations Development Program, facilitating the workshop, says having a well-established tax system across the country could strengthen the nation's economy and improve peace and stability. Owusu says once a proper taxation system is in place, the government can support development-related spending, especially in the areas of education, health, and building infrastructure.
Building a transparent, broad-based, and fair tax system with adequate tax infrastructure to raise much-needed non-oil tax receipts and reduce volatility is a priority which needs to be urgently addressed. And if we are to succeed in building a transparent and sustainable non-oil revenue generating system at state level, which I insist we must succeed, this will lessen South Sudan's reliance on borrowing.
South Sudan's inflation rate has more than doubled from 309.6% to 661.3% in the month of August, according to the South Sudan National Bureau of Statistics. The government devalued its currency last year, a move that weakened the economy even further. For VOA News, I am Wake Simon Wudu in Juba.
From Juba, we go to Nairobi, where the leader of the Federal Democratic Party says the economy of South Sudan can be rescued from collapse if the fighting stops. Gabriel Changston Chung says the economic crisis in South Sudan is due largely to the fact that the government spends most of its money on buying arms to fight the opposition. Changston tells show host John Tanza that the best way to stabilize the country's economy is to rebuild its hard currency reserves.
for South Sudan economy to recover and be a vibrant economy in a very short period of time, you have to end the war and end it immediately. If the war is ended tomorrow, then what is going to happen is that there will be no huge military budget for armaments. If that budget is slashed into half, where does that money go? It goes to development. Peace will restore the confidence of investors in South Sudan. Frozen funds from aid group or donors will eventually also be released. Oil production that is very low will now pick up and will result to more oil revenue.
Your recommendations sound fine, but it looks like it's a quick fix because the dollar is almost becoming a currency for transaction in South Sudan because the pound is weak. And for you to stabilize that, it takes time.
No, it doesn't take time. Once the peace is there, then the programs I'm talking about would be implementable. For instance, you have to cut the government expenditure. It doesn't take time. Okay, the other part of the macroeconomic policy is the monetary policy. You are talking about the exchange rate. How do we stabilize the exchange rate? How do we reduce the rate of inflation? Once peace is there, oil production has gone up. It means that South Sudan will begin to build foreign currency reserves. Once you have the reserves, then your currency is backed.
Let's look at the reasons why prices of items in Juba have skyrocketed. In fact, somebody was telling me it's 100% increase. At some point, the common men and women are not able to put food on the table. What are some of the reasons why these prices are going up?
Well, I think the reason is simple. First, the war effect is one of the factors. But I think it was in the middle of last year or what, when the pound was floated, because the pound was pegged to dollar at 2.96. Mm-hmm. Last year, that one was removed, and it jumped from 2.96 to 18.75. What was the reason? I suspect that the reason for making that huge leap or jump was driven by the quest for more local currency to pay salaries and services.
That's Federal Democratic Party leader Gabriel Changston Chung speaking to John Tanza in Nairobi. The head of the Bidibidi refugee settlement in Uganda's Yumbe district says ethnic divisions among South Sudanese refugees are undermining operations at the camp. Simon Peter Apiku has more for VOA from Yumbe district, Uganda.
With an estimated population of 240,000 refugees on this stretch of land that sits on about 240 square kilometers, the Bidibidi settlement is the largest refugee camp in Uganda. It was established in August to absorb the large influx of South Sudanese fleeing the conflict that erupted in July between government forces and troops loyal to former first vice president Riek Machar. David Wangwe is the top official in the Prime Minister's Department for Refugees Office and runs the camp. Wangwe says the refugees have a hard time peacefully coexisting.
The Dinkas, once they come, the other tribes don't want to stay with them. We've had the cases, especially in Zone 2, where we settled some Dinka refugees and then they attacked at night. They attacked at night and, of course, claiming these are the people who have forced us to flee our country. Well, yeah, they also again following us here. We can't stay with them in the same environment.
Those ethnic tensions often get in the way of processing and placing new refugees who arrive at the camp, according to Wangwe.
We don't create divisions or zones with different tribes, then we'll not be helping the situation. We, from the very beginning, we have assured them and told them that here we don't receive people based on tribes. When you run and cross your country, you come as a refugee, not as a Dinka, not as a Nuer, not as a Madi or a Choli or Pojulu. So you are all refugees with one common problem.
Wangwe says there have been a few cases when officials had to relocate certain individuals or families because of genuine concerns over their safety. In recent months, he says, refugees have also accused the South Sudanese government of sending security agents to refugee settlements to identify individuals associated with the armed opposition, which causes refugees to become suspicious of one another.
We've had the cases of people coming to complain that they are seeing their enemies around. Of course, when they are there, they had those divisions. So some were perceived to be elements, maybe in the security, and they could come and report. This person was in the army, but yeah, they also come here. They're the ones who made us run away. They're also following us here.
But Wangwe says his team has found no evidence to support these allegations. He says some refugees have tried to use these claims to justify their desire to be resettled in a third country, usually the United States or Europe. He says the authorities try to minimize ethnic tensions as much as possible to avoid altercations inside the camp.
So we are doing a lot of sensitizations with partners, to make sure that they live peacefully amongst themselves and also, of course, amongst the host communities.
The Ugandan authorities have also deployed a police force and army troops in and around the Bidibidi settlement to protect the refugees. For VOA News, I am Simon Peter Apiku in Yumbe District, Uganda.
You're tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. One hospital in Torit gets a helping hand from the UN Development Program in its fight against malaria. Find out how when we come back.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
do events in other countries affect you and your family?
Yes, a lot. Because I think in this country, Ghana, for example, whatever happens in the global world also affects us, especially the economy, because we export a lot.
It affects me because I work in Dubai. If there's a disaster, for example, there's a ban of where I'm working from, it means that I got to go out of work and probably my family won't get anything. They won't get money, they won't get any support.
Yes, but most especially in Nigeria, you see what is happening with Boko Haram. It started in Nigeria and it has affected Cameroon already. So they actually affect the national life and my family too.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
Starting December 1st, join South Sudan in Focus host John Tanza and members of the South Sudanese community for a discussion about how hate speech is threatening to undermine coexistence among South Sudanese, both at home and abroad.
We are all South Sudanese, and there is no way we can make it without each other. We are all in the same boat. Either we sing together or we are safe together.
If we keep on saying that we want revenge, then this hate is not going to stop.
Your degree is a responsibility to pass on to the next generation.
The conversations amongst the elders really influence the younger generations that are following
the way we communicate with each other.
Tune in to South Sudan in Focus Monday through Friday to hear voices from home and the diaspora discussing hate speech and its implications on VOA Africa.
You're tuned to South Sudan in Focus. It's time for our Tuesday Health segment, and today we're talking about efforts to fight the spread of malaria in South Sudan. The United Nations mission in South Sudan has donated hundreds of mosquito nets, bed covers, and blankets to Tarit Civil Hospital to help in the fight against malaria. Hospital officials in Tarit say the number of patients has dwindled because many people have deserted the town due to insecurity. Others in remote villages cannot access health care, as we hear from Dimo Silva Aurelio from Tarit.
ANMIS today handed over 300 mosquito bed nets, 150 bed sheets, 6 boxes of soap, and 150 blankets to health workers at Tarit Civil Hospital. Mary Cummins is the ANMIS field office chief in Tarit.
Yeah, well, we're very pleased on behalf of ANMIS here in Tarit to donate to the Tarit Hospital a number of sheets, blankets, mosquito nets and soap for the use of the patients who are attending this hospital. It's a very busy hospital.
Relatives of patients admitted at Tarit Civil Hospital are usually required to bring bed covers and mosquito nets for their loved ones who are receiving treatment. Apollonia Eholong was admitted to the neonatal department for observation after delivering her baby. Speaking in Arabic, Apollonia says she's glad she no longer has to provide her own bed covers.
We did not get the mosquito net here, and the hospital administration asked us to bring from home. But now that they have donated this much, we will not be bringing any from home.
Speaking in Arabic, Jane Lamono, who was admitted to Tarit State Hospital's gynecological ward, says she is thankful to ANMIS for providing mosquito nets.
The mosquito net helped a lot because mosquito bring a lot of disease in the body and can only be prevented by the mosquito net.
Ann Auma is the matron of Tarit Civil Hospital. Auma says the donations from ANMIS will also improve the hospital's hygiene conditions.
This gift is going to help us great deal in the hospital. In fact, like the bed sheets, we are lacking bed sheets. Now these bed sheets will help the patients, plus the mosquito nets and the blankets. This is really very good donation which they gave us. It will help us great deal.
Tarit residents have been coping with nearly 3 years of insecurity and economic hardship. Abo James, administrator of Tarit Civil Hospital, says the number of patients seeking treatment has dropped in recent months, but only because the state's rampant insecurity forced many families to hide in remote villages. He says others who can afford to pay for transport travel to Kenya or Uganda, where they seek refuge.
The number of patients who are attending services in the hospital in OPD clinics in the past 6 months, it was so higher, but due to some issues beyond the control or within the state or the national crisis, it dropped the population of patients from 250, it dropped to less than 100 patients a day, meaning that the town itself is depopulated.
Jamie says families in remote villages are not able to access health centers and are at the mercy of traditional healers.
We are worried because if the number decreases, it's meaning due to some obstacle, might be some are not coming to attend to medical service in the hospital, but they are resorting for other treatment, which is not the objective of the government.
Aboch says Imotongi State has few qualified personnel to provide quality health services, and the few medical personnel who are working in the state have not been paid since September. For VOA News, I am Dimo Silva Aurelio in Tarit.
About 100 Sudanese citizens demonstrated in front of the Sudanese embassy here in Washington over the weekend in support of a 3-day campaign of civil disobedience in Sudan that began on Sunday. The Bashir administration recently lifted subsidies on fuel and gas and hiked electricity prices to try to curb inflation. As a result, hundreds of thousands of Sudanese can no longer afford basic necessities. Nadia Taha attended the demonstration and has this report from Washington.
Bashir!
Down, down, El Bashir! Down, down, El Bashir!
Sudanese activist Duha Al-Mardi says they are standing together outside the Sudanese embassy in solidarity with the Sudanese people who are demanding political change in their country.
The Sudanese people have seen, since 1989, we have gone through years and years and years of rape and torture and exploitation. And I think that now people are really ready to voice out. People are really ready for a change.
Al-Mardi says the civil disobedience called by Sudanese youth has been largely successful because of social media, Facebook and Twitter.
The civil disobedience call started by Sudanese youth who are really have been going through a lot with this regime, and we are really fed up. So what happens is that the prices of the fuel increased, and then of course followed with increased the prices of almost everything, and then to top that, the prices of medicine has increased in a massive percentage. But we have already seen cases where people committed suicide because they are not able to afford medicine.
Khalid Al-Tujani is a founding member of the Sudanese National Movement for Change. Al-Tujani says the increases are hurting and even killing Sudan's poor.
You know, it is not just lifting subsidy from the oil itself, but even, you know, Sudan were facing some economic crisis since the division of South Sudan or independence of South Sudan in 2011. So the government is resorting every time to raise the prices of goods and commodities in trying to solve this problem. But every time, actually, because, you know, Sudan, according to the World Bank and Sudanese government, almost half of the people are under poverty. So they can afford, you know, this increasing in prices every time without any way to solve this problem, actually.
On Sunday, the first day of the civil disobedience movement, many neighborhoods in the capital and other big cities across Sudan were quiet. Very few pedestrians were seen outside. Most of the political opposition parties, such as the Umma Party and rebel movements like SPLM North, have declared their support for the civil disobedience and called on members to join the movement. More than 20 activists in different Sudanese cities have been arrested since the civil disobedience began, and authorities shut down two daily newspapers and a television station in Khartoum. President Omar al-Bashir has been in power for 27 years. He is wanted as a war criminal by the ICC for committing genocide and crimes against humanity in Darfur. For VOA News, I'm Nadia Taha in Washington.
And that's our show for this Tuesday. We leave you with the song Balumba by Bibi Philip featuring Eddie Kenzo.
Remix.
BBB on the track.
Mama tugende, baby Philip tugende, Eddie Kenzo tugende, Mwana Africa, Balumba remix, come dance with us, let's do the dance, Balumba. Call everybody, yeah. Here is the party, yeah.
Allez bien danser.
De batata
trapeta go beto male ma gele pa kwa ka te ba trapeta nga
bebe bi a positionné
ne di kenze position nanga ngendo to kone
fola se la melodie t'emporte kumule kumule kumule
kumule mama. We've been listening to Bebe Philip and Eddie Kenzo with the song Balumba. I'm Ayan Bior in Washington. Thanks for being here. Tune in again tomorrow evening for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.